call Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, February 1st, 2017. This is the Senate Resources Committee meeting in Juneau. Senators present today: Senator Meyer, Senator Stedman, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Hughes, and myself, Senator Giesel. I expect Senator Wilkowski and Senator Coghill along shortly. Thank you to Anne, who is recording this meeting, and Kyle, who is helping us with the audio, as well as my staff, Ike. Today we've got a couple things on the agenda. I will remind folks who are speaking to remember acronyms. Folks are listening online, and even the committee members may not know the acronyms, so if you'd help us out by the whole word. Today we're taking up two items. First, we're going to have an update from the Oil and Gas Competitiveness Review Board. The chair, as well as the revenue commissioner, are here today to present that. And then we're going to take up Senate Bill number 3 after that. Welcome, Senator Wilkowski and Senator Coghill. So our first item is the Competitiveness Review Board. So in 2013, this board was created when Senate Bill 21 passed, which was an overhaul of the state's oil production tax system. Section 31 of that bill created the Competitiveness Review Board. I have to say that really slowly because it's such a hard word to say. The board consists of 11 members. They come from the governor's cabinet, as well as the state's hydrocarbon regulatory authorities, and public members affiliated with the industry trade associations, as well as some members at large. There are some key duties for the Competitiveness Review Board. There are 5 of them, actually, that I've identified here. The first one: maintain relevant and obvious information about Alaska's petroleum fiscal regime. The second: review the level of investment in Alaska from the energy sector, past, present, and forecasting future commitments. Number 3, identify factors that influence those investment decisions. Number 4, identify Alaska's competitive peers and assess how our state stacks up compared to those other destinations. And lastly, make written findings and recommendations to this body, the legislative body, on how to improve our competitiveness. The board has met several times. Committee members who were here last year might remember then-chair Tom Hendricks presented to us. Today, we will hear from Mr. Weish Ford, who is the current chair. Mr. Ford is online. There he is. Yep. And so he'll be speaking to us, as well as Commissioner Randall Hoffbeck from the Department of Revenue. Both Commissioner Hoffbeck is on the commission. Of course, Mr. Ford is the chairman. So, welcome, gentlemen. Which of you, Commissioner Hoffbeck, you'll be beginning? Okay, great. Well, welcome, if you'd put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue. Online is Weish Ford, Chairman of the Oil and Gas Competitiveness Review Board. I have to say that word slow myself. Because it's difficult to do a presentation over the phone, I will walk us through the presentation, and Chairman Ford will chime in when it's appropriate. So with that, going to slide 2, and just real briefly, what we want to cover today is the history of the Oil and Gas Competitiveness Review Board, much of what the chairman has already covered, some of the future deliverables from the board, talk a little bit about Cook Inlet and Middle Earth under HB 247 and how that has affected the deliverables, and then give you an update on the deliverables and progress so far. As Chairman Giesel indicated, that we were formed under SB 21 and really created to advise the legislature on the state's fiscal system, issues surrounding the labor pool and regulatory competitiveness, as well as establishing and maintaining salient data regarding the oil and gas exploration, development, and production. There's a fairly lengthy description of that that can be found on the Department of Revenue's website. There's a link to the Competitiveness Review Board's website. And you can click on that and get a much more robust description of all the duties under SB 21. As part of our first deliverable, which was due in January 15th of 2015, there was actually a report that was completed at the end of February and delivered to the legislature actually in March of 2015. So it was delivered about 6 weeks late just because of the timing on getting it done. But that was delivered in 2015. And it covered much of the compilation of that salient data. It's a 92-page report that was delivered. It was really just it was gathering all of the public data that was available on the various components that the board was asked to look at, as well as some independent analysis that was done by Department of Revenue staff. I think when it was delivered, we were all just a little disappointed because there was a lot of holes in the data. You know, there was a lot of information that, quite frankly, is not out there, is not available. And so one of the things that the board embarked on at that point in time was to plug those holes. And if you remember, Tom Hendricks, when he was here, was seeking some funding to get some outside resources to help move that project along. So one of the difficulties that we're having with the board is, although it's got a really important function within the state, it really hasn't been given any resources at this point in time to do the work. And we've relied very heavily on the 11 members of the board and their expertise and their time and their staff, as well as the Department of Revenue's expertise and staff to deliver the product so far. But there's some of the issues that we're facing, such as, you know, competitiveness with other states, where, quite frankly, we know what we're doing here, but we don't necessarily know what they're doing in Texas or North Dakota to the extent that we can really provide good analysis to the legislature. And Weish, I didn't know if you wanted to make any comments at that point in time.
Yeah, thank you, Commissioner Hoffbeck. Yeah, that has been a limitation for the board, as you just highlighted.
Mr.
We
Ford?
We have an opportunity, I think, if you can hear me okay, to...
Mr. Ford?
Yes.
Could you begin by identifying yourself for the record?
Yes. So this is Weish Ford. I'm the current chairman of the Oil and Gas Competitiveness Review Board.
Thank you.
I'm calling in from Anchorage. I'm sorry I had a last-minute conflict and could not travel.
Go ahead and give us your comments. Thanks so much.
Yes. So as Commissioner Hoffbeck was highlighting, one of the challenges we have is addressing due to the research and analysis being an unfunded board and volunteer time. We've identified some opportunities to cooperate by input to studies being done by others in an attempt to ensure that they're being presented in a balanced way, which is what I really see as the purpose of the board is a resource to the legislature to give, I think, a balanced view in comparison of the fiscal regime, tax structures, as well as regulatory regime that affect the competitiveness of the oil and gas industry. You know, we're not an organization that forms policy, but we simply try to understand where we are currently in comparison to others so that we understand the effects of potential changes. Again, one of the limitations we've had is resources to do some of the necessary financial analysis and have it done in a way that's accepted by a broad cross-section, I guess, of the legislature as well as others. So that's what Commissioner Hoffbeck was speaking to.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Ford. Moving on with this slide, again, Chairman Giesel laid out the makeup of the board, but let me put just a little bit more detail in it. There are two public members. They are specifically not involved in the oil and gas industry by statute. There's a three administrative department heads. That's DEC, DNR, and Department of Revenue. There's one commissioner from the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. There's three oil and gas subject matter experts, and they're specifically one petroleum engineer, one geologist, and one financial analyst, and then two trade group representatives that are nominated by the trade groups and appointed by the governor. So it's got a pretty broad spectrum of expertise on the board, and frankly was a pretty amazing the first round of the board was a pretty amazing group of people to work with. The initial board that was all appointed in July 1st of 2014, And you can see the list there. After the initial delivery in January, we started to gear up to start filling in the gaps, and then we just started losing board members. And we had five of them that, or six of them that actually, no, five of them that left just because of personal commitments. I mean, they were in the industry, they were working, their businesses were challenged, and they just said, we just can't commit the time that they had put in before. And so they had to resign. And, of course, then the two commissioners that flipped as well. So we ended up with essentially a brand new board being put together after the end of 2015. The board was reconstituted by mid-2016, and we really started off on the process of looking at the deliverable for January of this year. We then ran into and we actually, as we looked at it, we came to the conclusion that it was going to be a difficult report to construct because the focus was Cook Inlet tax regime. And because of the significant changes that were made to the Cook Inlet tax regime under HB 247 that were really in the transition phase right now, that it would have been, we thought, premature to deliver a report halfway through a transition to a new tax regime, that we wouldn't give you the type of data that you would really would have been looking for in that. The next page, slide six, is actually the last two deliverables, specific deliverables that are laid out in statute. As I said, the report that was due January 15th of this year was specifically focused on the Cook Inlet tax regime. And then there's another report that was due January 31st of 2021 that was a larger statewide review of the state's tax system and competitiveness. When we hit when we realized in the middle of the summer that the 2015 or 2017 deliverable was probably not going to occur, we wrote a letter to LBNA. Informing that we didn't think that it made sense to do the report and asked for a delay of 2 years in delivering the report. They wrote back and said they didn't really have jurisdiction to grant us a reprieve from delivering the report. So once the new legislature formed after the elections, we sent letters to both the President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House, also informing them that we thought it would be best if we delayed the report till 2019 in order to have something that was worth reporting on. If you want to just real briefly, the next two slides look at really the changes in the Cook Inlet Middle Earth tax regime, which is where the report would have been focused. And I'm not going to drill down on these. It's just there more as an illustrative of just the significant changes that were made to the Cook Inlet tax regime. And really, by the end of this calendar year, there won't be a credit program in Cook Inlet anymore, and there will be a $1 a barrel oil tax and a 17.7 cents on the average gas per MCF gas tax, and that will be the structure within Cook Inlet. So it's going from a fairly complex system to a very simple system, and we quite frankly don't know how the market's going to react to that yet. Jumping to slide nine, then, which is just an excerpt from the letter requesting the extension to July 15th, 2019. Talking about the 2021 deliverable just a little bit on slide 10. It was an idea that came out of the governor's office and working with AOGA, and they said, okay, well, we don't have really a viable 2017 delivery, but we don't have to wait till 2021 to start talking about the broader state competitiveness. And so we tried to create a joint effort between AOGA and the administration to contract for a report. The reason we wanted to do a joint effort was because we recognized that in the general public, if AOGA puts a report out, there's going to be a sector of the public that's going to think it's biased to industry. And if the administration puts a report out, there's going to be a certain sector in the public that thinks it's biased for the administration. And we thought if we could do a joint report, we could have something that everybody could feel comfortable was an unbiased reflection of the state's competitiveness. because of some appropriation and procurement issues, we weren't able to put together a joint effort. So AOGA has contracted with Wood Mackenzie to put together a report, and we are working with DNR, the DOR, and the governor's office to cobble together finances to put together a separate report using similar scope of work and similar deliverables. And then the idea is that the Oil and Gas Competitive Review Board will take the two reports and will actually compile them and isolate the similarities and the differences, so we can kind of get a range of perspective on where there's differences and where there's commonality. We can show that there's some certainty here, and I think really take some of the bias out of the discussion and hopefully let everybody feel comfortable with what the report that's being delivered is a balanced report, and so that will go before the board at our next meeting, which is still in the process of being scheduled for approval, but both Weish and I strongly support that process, as well as Commissioner Mack with DNR. So I'm 100% certain that the board will agree that to be that unbiased third party to look at the reports. So that's kind of where the Oil and Gas Competitiveness Review Board sits right now. And I don't know, maybe Chairman Ford might have some additional comments.
Mr. Ford, further comments from you?
Yes, just very briefly, some of you, so thank you. Just want to thank you for the opportunity to give you this update and to increase the awareness of the board's function. And quite frankly, also make a request that while we understand sort of the mission of the board, we haven't seen evidence of utilization of the board's work. And so, I guess the simple request or ask is what is the proper method or engagement by committees or the legislative staff to engage with the board for this information?
Thank you, Mr. Ford. And I agree. You have been given a large task, as the commissioner has articulated, with no funding, volunteers to do a formidable job. But you're right. While the legislation was well-intended, the legislature has sort of forgotten that resource is there. And so I appreciate the diligence. I appreciate AOGA stepping up. And I also want to acknowledge that Kara Moriarty is in the audience. She is a member of this board, has been since the beginning, and represents the organization that's willing to fund the Wood Mackenzie piece of it. Also, John Hendricks is here, special advisor to the governor, and was on the original Competitiveness Review Board. So, I appreciate also the request to delay the report. It's just too soon to evaluate what's happened in Cook Inlet. But it's probably a conversation that the legislature, as we go through the budget process, needs to think about. Either this board exists and we're willing to give it some type of resource, or we need to not have it. So, again, a policy discussion.
And
Commissioner?
And to comment on that, the number of hours that the original 11 put in to put that original report out was pretty amazing. Multiple meetings, multiple edits. And then some of my staff that actually compiled the report, basically as other duties as assigned, it was quite an effort to get that report out. And I'm not so sure that wasn't part of the reason that we dropped some members when we went back in to try and fill in some of the holes, that people realized that they just couldn't make that kind of commitment. So some resources moving forward would certainly help the process.
Sure. Senator Wilkowski.
So has there been any budget for the review board at all since its inception, and do you have access to any independent experts as you do your evaluation of their competitiveness?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, there has not been a budget for the committee since it was formed. The Department of Revenue has covered all transportation and meeting costs for members. Members have been good about teleconferencing meetings as much as we possibly can to keep those costs low. And then it was revenue staff and staff of the various members that did the work.
So. Follow-up, Senator Wilkowski.
How much has the Department of Revenue spent on this board?
through the chair, Senator Wilkowski. We haven't tracked the hours. I don't know that I could give you an exact number, but we had one person that spent probably 3 to 4 months compiling the report, almost as a full-time project.
Follow-up, Senator Wilkowski.
I'd be curious to get some numbers from you, from how much staff time has been spent, salary that's been incurred, and then the travel costs that have been incurred, expenses in general. And then you said you have no access to experts at this point.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, we don't have through direct funding. As I said, AOGA is now funded an expert, and the Department of Revenue, Department of Natural Resources, and the governor's office are cobbling together the money to fund the expert as well. But it's all coming out of kind of year-end funds that have loosened up. And we will do our best to make estimates on the amount of time that's been spent on it, the man hours and the cost, but they're going to be pretty broad estimates because we didn't track it specifically.
Thank you. Senator Hughes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned that it's been difficult to gather information from other states, North Dakota, Texas, and I was wondering if that extended to around the world as well, and if the charge of the board is to be able to compare to see how competitive. And I confess I haven't read the earlier report, just wondering how you're able to meet your goal if you're not able to collect the information from these other locations, and how are you compensating for that?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, when you read the first report, you're going to see that there is a little bit of outreach outside the borders of the U.S., but most of it's focused on competitiveness within the U.S. We used a lot of published data. I know my staff reached out and contacted taxing departments in North Dakota and Texas, and I think Wyoming. I have to look at the list and found out what their base structure is. But as we know, even from our tax law, this is the rate, but then underneath that, there's a lot of other stuff going on, and we don't have that depth of knowledge. And that's where Wood McKinsey, I think, will be a real benefit, because you know that's their business, and so they'll have a better baseline knowledge. The timing on the report to try and get something delivered to the legislature this session is such that it'll be probably a lot of off-the-shelf data that they have, but we expect that they have a lot of that data already available to them.
Further questions for the Commissioner or Mr. Ford? All right, seeing none. Thank you very much, Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Ford, thank you for calling in. Did you have any closing comments?
No, I think that's a good representation. Thank you, Senator Giesel.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And so I would encourage committee members to take a look at the report. It's online. We can certainly, my staff can certainly send the link to that report so you can take a look at it. I know many of you didn't serve on resources prior to this. So, all right. The next subject, we're on to our second agenda item. This is Senate Bill 3. Senate Bill 3 proposes continuing a discharge exemption for certain vessels and applying a waiver for the 1% for ART program for the new Alaska class ferries being built for use in the Alaska Marine Highway. So the 1% for ART provision dates back to 1975. Requires that if capital budget money is spent on public facilities, that 1% of the construction cost go toward the acquisition and or installation of artwork. In 2006, the voter initiative imposed discharge standards. These were applied to also the Alaska Marine Highway, but they were then exempted. So I believe Senator Stedman has some thoughts on that, and so I welcome him to the table to present his bill.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I thought I'd take this opportunity, being a committee member, to sit here in the hot seat and give my fellow colleagues some entertainment today where they could ask me questions. Anyway, what we have before us is, as the chairman had mentioned, an extension bill. And then there's another component on the ART bill. So if we take a look at the exemption, we have in our coastal waters smaller ships, most of them are older, particularly in the Marine Highway. They're almost as old as I am. They're some of them 50 years old, and I wish I was closer to 50 than I am my own age. But nonetheless, if we were to require the Marine Highway to come into compliance without this exemption, what we're doing is facing a cost issue on ships that were, frankly, phasing out, the older ones, and then the newer ones is, frankly, a cost and a design issue. And when you have old ships, if you open them up and have to rehab or refab them, normally your estimates are low, and I think the cost estimates are about $5 million on some of these changes. So we got to be very careful with that, and then dealing with our newer ships, exempting them, the three newer ones, two under construction, one coming. You know, we've had substantial budgetary strains, as we're all well aware, and trying to modernize this fleet has been financially challenging. So this all kind of goes together. Clearly, what we've seen around Southeast waters is no visible impact from these exemptions. My office has not had complaints from the constituents and concerns dealing with discharge from the Marine Highway at all. So it's really, quite frankly, a non-issue. The smaller cruise ships, there's always less than 250 or so. There's always concern with those. But when you take a look at trying to bring those into compliance, you start changing the stability of the ships, and the costs go way up. Some of the information we've got that have trouble even amortizing those costs. And, again, we have not had a lot of complaints or issues from the smaller cruise ships. So with us, for backup support on this, we've got representation from the Marine Highway and DEC for more technical data. The other side of the bill, the other portion of the bill, is we're required, with all good intention, to spend 1% of our capital money on artwork, and we all like to have nice-looking buildings. But dealing with the Marine Highway, we're going to be retiring vessels. I think one of them is in the news today, if anybody wants it for free for coastal town for public use, they could have it. I'd be very careful with taking the gifted horse, I guess, on that one. But with that being said, there's nice artwork in that ship, and we could take artwork out of our old ships and put it in our new ones, or we could get art out of copies out of the museums. We can put art in the boat, our new ships, without going out and spending a lot of money. So it's like $1 million for the two ships, and then the next one, the Testamina, could be a couple $1 million. So it's a sizable chunk. I don't want the public to get the impression we're going back to the gulag days of Soviet Russia, and we're going to have those designs that we all saw that are just boring and horrible looking. I mean, we're not doing that. We just want to not have to be forced to buy new artwork. We'll use existing art and still have a nice-looking vessel, because we want to attract tourism on it. We want our constituents and fellow Alaskans to be comfortable on it. So that's pretty straightforward piece. When we go to build further ships or other ships outside of the three that are targeted, I guess we'll have that conversation here in the legislature and see how it worked for these three and what kind of finances we have. And with that, Madam Chairman, that's pretty much what this bill does. Some of us worked on a cruise ship discharge several years ago, so it's not a new issue. And the most contentious part of that whole subject matter is not applicable to this bill. So we're just basically keeping status quo. And it's worked well, and I'd encourage support. And like I mentioned earlier, I've got substantial backup behind me for all the technical questions from DEC and Marine Highway, because I'm not a biologist and nor a ferry captain. So I'll defer some of those questions possibly to better capable people in that arena. And that's it, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Questions for Senator Stedman on the bill?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Coghill.
So the way I understand the way the retroactivity does is it goes back to the original requirements and gives this modification, and we move forward. So this is this law would go on from then, pick up, and at this point there's no sunset date on it?
That's my understanding, and I think we're actually would have been nice in the perfect world to do it a year ago. But.
Yeah. Okay. I just wanted to make sure that the effective date was to go back and pick it up where it dropped off and then just move it in perpetuity on forward.
Yes, Madam Chairman, if I could to the Chair. It would be nice to not have a sunset date on it. You know, our ownership of these two new ferries are probably going to last 50 years, and the other cruise ships, the smaller ones, they'll be running around our waters for probably decades. So, but also they have to manage it with best management practices. So the industry doesn't get a free ride. DEC sets standards they have to meet. In fact, the standards are actually been tightened up over the last several years on this first extension, and I think that's one reason why we don't have a lot of complaints. So I'm Chairman, forget to mention that they do have best practices, the best management practices to comply with. So they're not getting a free ride by any means. And DEC is, from my experience working with them, take a high degree of concern with the environment for Alaskans to live in, both on land and water.
Very good. Further questions? Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I was just reading through the bill here. When did this sunset?
Senator Stedman.
January 1st, 2016, I think.
So, Madam Chair, if I may,
yes,
that's
Senator that, Meyer, follow up.
That's about a year ago. So what's been happening during this year? We've been breaking the law? Or you probably don't want to put that on record, but.
We have very law-abiding marine-related businesses, but I think this did, and maybe the Marine Highway officials in D.C. would be better to answer that question, but I think we just ran past the deadline and frankly oversaw it and picked it up. I don't think it was intentional.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sure. We do have DEC and representatives from DOTPF in the room, and so why don't we have them come forward to answer some of these issues, perhaps starting with DEC. I know Michelle Hale is here, so welcome, Ms. Hale. Please come to the table and give us your thoughts.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Resource Committee for having us here. My name is Michelle Hale, and I am the Director of the Division of Water at DEC. And with me is Ben White, who is the Cruise Ship Program Manager within the Division of Water. He has more technical expertise in this area than I do, so he may need to answer some questions.
All right. Mr. White, you heard some of the questions. You want to offer some answers, perhaps?
Sure, Madam Chair. As far as the exemption and the timing and what we've been doing since January of 2016, we've been working with both AMHS and small vessel operators to continue operating as they have. A lot of the best management practice plans are good for 5 years. So when we approve it, we review it, we'll approve it for 5 years. So a large majority of the vessels have been covered under an already approved plan. Those newer vessels, we went ahead and asked them to submit a best management practices plan. We reviewed it and offered them some technical expertise to review it, but it's not an approved plan. So we've been operating under the previous process up to this point.
Great. Good information. Other questions? Yes, Senator Coghill.
So it looks like we're going to require a five-year plan. Just give us a time frame of what it takes some of these smaller vessels to go through that planning process. Is it something that is pretty static? or is it upgraded based on new technology? So just give us an idea of the planning process, because it looks like we're going to give you regulatory authority, and we always hate giving you more regulatory authority. So is it going to become a little more arcane, or is it pretty simple?
Madam Chair, Senator, we currently have regulations in place that spell out what is required in these best management practices plans. 18 AAC 69 outlines details on what's required. Currently, the process is we'll go through registration, vessel operators will submit vessel-specific sampling plans and their best management practices plans simultaneously. The requirements outline everything from an engineer's report to explaining when they will conduct their sampling and the requirements that are laid out in regulation. These typically will take some of the smaller operators a little bit of time to develop. They don't have the staff and the resources that the larger commercial vessels have, so the larger cruise ships, the cruise lines, they don't have the expertise in-house, so we assist them in developing these plans, and we have staff engineers that help them with this. And so typically it takes us about a month back and forth to get these developed. And then once they're in place, we will work with the smell vessel operators and Alaska Marine Highways. If there's updates to the system or due to sample results that come back, if we look at the sample results and they're not as good as performing operations as we'd like, and there's modifications that happen, we'll modify the best management practices plans as we go.
And I think
I'll up Senator Croghill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's a good answer. There are sometimes it takes 3 years to renew a five-year permit, and so it sounds like to me you got it cut down pretty good. So, mm-hmm.
Yes, Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. Do you have the bill in front of you? So I could get you to go to page 3, section 5 and 6. Just trying to understand some terminology here. So section 5 says except as provided in H of this section or under, or, and then you're adding or under a plan for a small commercial passenger vessel approved under the statute, a person may not discharge sewage from a commercial passenger vessel into marine waters of the state that has suspended solids greater than 150 milligrams per liter of a fecal coliform count greater than 200 colonies per 100 milliliters. What's like, so how much water are we talking about, or how much sewage are we talking about being discharged into the marine waters on an average commercial, one of these commercial vessels?
So through the chair, Senator, we've provided you guys just kind of a brief table, a bar chart that demonstrates sort of an average discharge from these vessels. Due to the size, there's a lot of water conservation that takes place, and so we're not seeing quite the amount of discharge on these smaller vessels. There's fewer people, fewer showers, and so we see less discharges from these small vessels.
I'm looking at the chart now. Thank you for pointing it out. So that's 11,619 gallons on a daily basis average?
That's correct.
Okay. And then if I could, so how much, how to what level is that treated? I mean, they're not dumping raw sewage, right? This is treated in some way. This is like gray water.
Through the chair, Senator, they're still required to process and treat, so that we're not talking untreated sewage. Most of these vessels, if not all of them, have installed some sort of treatment system. They've got what we call a marine sanitation device, and there's different types of these, but they're certified by the Coast Guard. They go through a process of certification. They have to meet specific standards as far as discharge limits and levels, and that's also tied in with EPA water quality standards. And so on the federal level, these marine sanitation devices will become certified. They're installed, and then what we do as a program is we go out and monitor to make sure that they're still meeting and performing at that level.
follow-up, Senator Wilkowski.
Is it treated with chemicals? Are there other chemicals that are released into the marine waters after the treatment?
Through the chair, Senator, some of these are treated with chlorine. So there are some cases where it depends on the system. Some of them are more of a biological system where they'll actually perform more like a septic tank is what folks are more familiar with. So over a course of time through a process, they're treated that way. Other systems use chlorine, so there is some chemical involved. And then it's also we monitor for those as well so that there's not an additional load of chlorine going into the system.
Senator Wilkinson.
Just out of curiosity, so the standard is suspended solids greater than 150 milligrams per liter. What would be comparable allowable number of suspended solids or fecal coliform count in, say, a drinking water? What's the allowable limit?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I'll go ahead and answer that question.
Identify yourself quickly just for the secretary.
Yes, I am Michelle Hale, and I am the director of the Division of Water at DEC. It's really not, I don't know if I could say possible, it's really not appropriate to compare wastewater standards with drinking water standards. So, for example, with a drinking water sample, the limit for coliforms is zero. You're not supposed to have any coliforms, but it's actually not really appropriate to try to make that comparison. It's often made, but we're talking about treating water for completely different purposes. So these waters discharge into a marine environment, and they don't discharge into an area where anybody will be drinking the water. So,
okay. Thank you. Follow-up, Senator Wilkowski.
So we're making an exception. We're saying under Section 5 as it currently is written, a person may not discharge sewage that has suspended solids greater than 150 milligrams. But we're making an exception saying, well, you can go above that limit. So what limits do you allow them to go to on a milligrams per liter of fecal coliform? You see what I'm saying?
So through the chair, Senator, these limits are placed in here, and we don't allow them to go above these, but we understand that there's limitation in the equipment. There's situations that may happen, and that's part of why the program monitors the actions and activities. And so if we do see an exceedance of these standards, we work with the operators, whether it's AMHS, Alaska Marine Highway System, or the small commercial passenger vessels, we'll work with the operators to try and identify what the system, where there's a problem with the system, and a lot of times we will conduct additional sampling after the system has been modified, and it will drop it back down to acceptable standards. So,
follow up, Senator Wilkowski.
Let me clarify that question. So, under existing law, a commercial passenger vessel cannot dump in marine waters in excess suspended solids greater than 150 milligrams. This bill in Section 5 and Section 6 would amend that to allow a plan for a small commercial passenger vessel approved under AS 4603462K. So what I'm trying to get at is what would DEC approve? What level of suspended solids would they approve under a plan? What's the maximum level?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I'll take that question. And again, I'm Michelle Hale, Director of the Division of Water at DEC. The Best Management Practices Plan that will be a result of this legislation is just that. It's a detailed plan for each ship, addressing how that ship can operate optimally to reduce the levels as much as possible. So the plan itself does not have limits, but our staff monitor the sampling and the operation of those systems on those vessels very closely, and they work very closely with the operators on an ongoing basis to continue to drive those levels down. We also, in this, in the packet, I believe, or at least on the website, there's a report of sampling results from 2016 as well as on our cruise ship website. So those results give you an idea of actually what kinds of levels we're seeing in these samples.
Do you know what page that is?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, the report will look like this, and I'm not sure if it's in your packet today, but it is on the website for SB 3.
Senator Wilikowski, I believe it looks like this, and it's in the packet that was on your desk.
Okay.
And it's about, looks like it's 3 pages worth of these detailed, oh no, it's many more than that. It looks like it's 5 pages of these detailed charts.
Okay, great. Thank you.
So, Senator Von Imhoff, you had a question.
Well, thank you. I suspect that it might be answered in these pages here that I did not look at, but I'll ask it. It's a quick one. You will review and test results of wastewater samples. You're going to inspect ships for compliance, monitor air emissions, and then check their wastewater. Is annually? What's the frequency?
Through the chair, Senator, this is an annual process, and so for us, our staff of our 4 are working pretty hard during the cruise ship season, and so we spend an awful lot of time reviewing these vessels and going through doing inspections. We try to look at every vessel at least once a year, and in some cases we'll actually inspect and observe vessels more than once a year, just depending on past performance and their responsiveness to our questions and willingness to work with us. So.
Follow-up, Senator Von Imhoff.
And is it generally like a surprise visit, or is it prearranged?
Through the chair, Senator, no. Most of these are, we have to notify them ahead of time, let them know that we're going to come down and ask for permission to get on board these vessels. And so we work with them, and this program has been fairly successful just because of the responsiveness of the small vessel operators. We're not working with foreign flag vessels and having to go through that process like the large ships. And so we do have a little bit more access. Part of it is just timing for them as far as when their paying customers can get on and off. And so we try not to be a burden to their normal operations.
So, Mr. White, just for clarification, the discharge standards were imposed in 2006. So that's, let's say, 10 years ago to round numbers. And my understanding is that these discharge standards have been in place this whole time, and this exemption for the small vessels have been in place this whole time as well. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair, that is correct. And this exemption is an exemption from obtaining a permit. And so while the BMPs have been in place, we do have data for 10 years now, a little over 10 years. And we have seen an improvement.
Thank you. And so while it's an exemption from a permit, it has not exempted them from your monitoring program.
Correct.
Thank you. Further questions? Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you. And appreciate getting this. Thank you to staff as well. So just for a point of comparison, so the statute sets a limit of 150 milligrams per liter of fecal coliform. What, and then you've got some comparables for like the City and Borough of Juneau, then you've got Olympic-sized swimming pool, you've got a large cruise ship. So what is the fecal coliform levels that are allowed by a large cruise ship, for example?
Through the chair, Senator, the statute, this is the limits that the large vessels operate under as well.
Okay, so it's 150 milligrams per
Correct.
Fecal. Okay, so if I'm reading this correctly, it's page 7 of this this document here, and it looks like it's, I don't know, the 7th or 8th column over, fecal coliform bacteria, and there's some like the Columbia, which is 64, but then you go down and there's the Matanuska, which is 170,000 fecal coliform milligrams fecal coliform per, wait a sec, 170,000 milligrams per liter, I guess that's what it is. Is that right?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, and this is Michelle Hale with the Division of Water, DEC. The units for fecal coliform bacteria are fecal coliform per 100 milliliters. Okay. And so what you're seeing in this column is the variability that we were talking about, and when our staff receive a result that's high, like that 170,000, they work with the operator. Usually the operator will call them right away, and we work with the operator to try to make tweaks to the operation and maintenance of the system to improve those numbers. And what we have seen in fecal coliform specifically since 2004, we've seen results go, the results in 2000, over the 10 years from 2004, I believe the results, the average results decreased by something like 90%.
Thank you. Follow-up, Senator Wilkoski?
Yeah, so just going down here, then the next one is Matanuska 8,900, and then you've got one that, which is 2,100,000. I mean, that is that like raw sewage?
Senator Wilkoski, through the chair, no, that's not raw sewage. Again, these systems are very variable, and operations on the cruise ships and the ferries are also very variable. So it really depends on what's going on in the moment on the ships. So what we've been doing through the Best Management Practices Program is working very hard with the operators of the ships to reduce that variability.
Okay.
Yes, yeah. Senator Wilkoski.
And I'm just trying to understand how the best practice process works and how you establish these plans. So, because we're giving you really a tremendous amount of authority to establish plans. And so you see a ship that has 170,000, which is, I don't know, 100,000 times the limit for large cruise ships, or this in other case, 2.1 million. Do you mandate that they lower the fecal coliform levels, or do you fine them, or what do you do? Is it mandatory requirements to get them to lower the amounts? I mean, what do you do?
Senator Wilkoski, through the chair, the whole point of the Best Management Practices Program and the plans is continuous improvement. So what we do is we work very closely, and typically when there's a high result, we work very closely with the vessel operators to conduct maintenance and improve operations and then resample. And typically what we see is when they resample, those levels are vastly reduced. So it's an ongoing process.
So,
Senator Wilkoski, did you have a follow-up?
I do. So when was this slide, when were, I guess these were different tests that were done on different ships, and because the average was 212,000. So, and there were, I mean, there were some, there were certainly a number of them that were within the limits, but then there were some that were just astronomically higher, right? So, I'm giving you, as a lawmaker, if I vote for this, really a tremendous amount of discretion, and I just want to know that there will be some progress made. So, when were these taken, and do you have sort of secondary tests that you can show me that show that there were decreases that were made?
So through the chair, Senator, I would have to defer to DOT on the amount of effort that they've gone through to refurbish and make these systems work. However, there are dates indicated on the far left-hand side of that table that indicate when those samples were taken. And in some cases, we work with the small vessel operator, and either the results have come in and we don't have them currently at this point in time, or in some cases we'll allow the small vessel operator to go in and do what's best for their equipment, and then when they come back the following year, or in the case with the Alaska Marine Highway System, they'll spend some time working on the vessel, and then we say, well, next year when we do our annual sampling, we'll take a look at the results and see if the efforts that were taken have improved the system.
Mr. White, two questions for you. The limit of 150, where did that come from? Did that come from the initiative that was passed, EPA? Do you know the origin of that standard?
Senator Giesel, Chairman Giesel, the origin of that standard is, as I understand it, is an EPA standard, but that is a standard that is in place and used by the Coast Guard in their regulations.
Okay. And my second question is, again, referring to page 7 of 11 on this chart, looking at the Matanuska, The first date there is 7/20/16, so July 20th of 16, and that is when we see that level of 170,000, pardon. And then approximately, well, less than a week later, on August 15th of 2016, the number is down to 8,900. So that reflects a retesting and improvement.
Senator Giesel, that is correct. And that is what we see very frequently as we are working with these vessels.
Very good. Thank you. It sounds like we may some of our other questions may be best answered by DOT at this point. Other questions for DEC? Just Environmental more, Conservation. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, so like Chichagof Dream, there was tested on 7/31, it was 2,100,000. But then it was tested a month later, it was zero. So obviously they're capable of getting to zero, right? So why wouldn't we want to say you got to keep it at 100? I mean, if there's totally discretionary and there's no penalties involved, and they do 2,100,000, but they can get it down to zero. I mean, wouldn't we want some stricter standards on that?
Senator Wilikowski, we always want improvement, and we always want the best water quality coming from these effluents as possible. The purpose of the best management practices plan and process is to continually encourage that improvement. So as I've said, the results reflect that when there are high values, and this happens in other industries as well, the industry is very responsive to those values.
Senator Von Imhoff had a question.
What usually causes a large jump and then, of course, a fall? But why the big variability?
Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair, wastewater treatment systems are kind of living organisms, and they respond to conditions in the environment. So small changes can actually create sometimes large variability in results. The purpose, again, of the best management practices plans and process is to continually work with the operators of the system and the way those systems are operated. So they actually respond to changes in what comes into the system and in what's going on in the vessel.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Of course, stand by, but we'll invite DOTPF to come forward and talk to us about the systems, the cost of them, etc. So thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman. I'm Michael Musil, the Deputy Commissioner in the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities overseeing the Alaska Marine Highway System. I don't know if you want to start with questions or if I can make a couple remarks.
If you would like to make some remarks, you can probably answer some questions with those remarks.
Okay, I will do that. Thank you. First and foremost, I would state that the Department of Transportation and the Marine Highway System fully supports this bill. We work very closely with the Department of Environmental Quality. We have an ongoing working relationship with them that includes training, monitoring of our systems, feedback on those results, corrective activities on those results. In the particular instance of the table that Senator Wilikowski was referring to, I will note, and to answer Senator Von Imhoff's question, that another reason for a spike in these numbers could be the footnote down at the very bottom left corner of that page, which says that hold time or temperatures exceeded on a local result. Depending on how you do the testing, if you don't do it properly or if it sits too long, it can actually get worse with time. So you can have a bad sample that shows up. DEC gets the report on that. We self-report on that. We take immediate action to correct that problem, retest, and perhaps come up with a much lower result immediately after that because the sample from the first one was bad. So there are a variety of reasons why you can get a outrageous-looking number on these samples. I will also point out that the Marine Highway System, as the good senator pointed out, we operate a fleet of old ships. We do not operate a fleet of old marine sanitation devices on those ships. We have done continual upgrades as part of the best management practices exemption that we have working with DEC to continually upgrade those marine sanitation devices. In fact, on the five ships that this applies to in the Marine Highway fleet, all of them between 2009 and 2011 have had a major upgrade in the marine sanitation device, the treatment systems that are on those ships, to improve wastewater discharge quality. It is important to note, I think, for you as a governing body, that this is a reinstatement of an existing regulation that has been in place for 10 years and worked very well for 10 years. As the Senator stated, we haven't gotten complaints. We're very cognizant of our discharges. We know where no discharge zones are. We don't discharge in port. Ship's crews monitor that, and they're trained to monitor that and pay attention to those details. I will like to correct two things, I think, for the record. One, the Alaska-class ferries that are being built, this regulation does not apply to them. Many of the smaller vessels in the Marine Highway fleet, including the Alaska-class ferries, are no-discharge vessels. They collect their gray water and black water on board in holding tanks. They pump it ashore, and it's treated through municipal wastewater treatment facilities. The fast ferries, the Chinooka, the Fairweather, the Laconi, the Aurora, they all pump ashore. They don't process at sea and discharge. So the Alaska-class ferries will do the same thing. They are a pump ashore vessel. The other factor is that the Tustamina replacement vessel, as designed, will fall under these requirements. The current Tustamina does not. It does not have enough overnight accommodations to meet the standard to have to comply with these regulations. The Tustamina replacement vessel is an enhanced capability vessel. It will meet that standard of 50 lower berths is the terminology used, essentially how many bottom bunks are there in the staterooms for the passengers, and it will have to comply with these regulations. So I think I mistakenly provided information to your staffs that did not apply. I stand corrected on that. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you. Questions? Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. So the ships that don't have the holding capacity, is it possible for them to put that holding capacity in, or is that just really expensive so that they could dump on shore?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, it is not practical. The Columbia or the Malaspina, for example, going all the way down to Bellingham back 2.5-day journey, not possible to hold that much wastewater on board. It needs to be treated, processed, and discharged overboard. Smaller vessels on day runs out and back, they can connect and pump ashore.
A follow-up, Senator Wilikowski?
Yeah, just when you're running down to Bellingham, I would assume there's probably a huge portion of it that's not in state waters, right? Do you dump in international waters or in Washington state waters?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, the rules are continually changing on that. We don't actually travel in international waters. We're on the inside passage the whole way, so it's Canadian internal waters. We are allowed to discharge going through Canadian international or through Canadian waters. The entirety of Puget Sound is under consideration right now to become a no-discharge zone for the entire Puget Sound from the Canadian border down to Bellingham, where our terminal is. We were advised of that potential and looked at our vessels. We do have the capacity to hold on board the gray water and black water produced by the vessel to get into port, back out of port before they start processing and discharging. So we can accommodate that type of a restriction. There are certain places in Alaska that are no discharge zones near fisheries critical habitat areas that we don't discharge through. So we do have some limited holding capacity, but not enough for the entire voyage.
Thank you. Yeah. Another follow-up?
Yeah, just one more. So, yeah, and I just remember reading some months ago about Puget Sound. They tested fish there, and they found huge percentages of drugs, like Prozac, I think, in the salmon down there. Is there any, I don't see that, any testing, has there been any testing of that in the discharge from the Marine Highway vessels?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, not that I'm aware of. We don't necessarily test for things that aren't on the list of standard items to test for. But as the DEC representative said, some treatment systems use chlorine. Vessels have chemicals on board. So there are instances where kind of strange things pop up in a sample. And it's good that we sample to catch those so we can trace where that came from and correct that problem.
Senator Hughes, question.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to change the subject. So if someone has another discharge discharge question I could hold off.
Well, I did have another one concerning discharge. Could you describe the collection process that might skew a result? What kind of factors?
To the chair, sampling of wastewater systems is, there's a certain procedure to it. In fact, I think the samples, and DEC can correct me if I'm wrong, they might need to be refrigerated. So they take a sample, they actually refrigerate it so that it doesn't continue to grow and multiply colonies by the time it gets to the lab to get tested, things like that. So it's a pretty rigid process. We have that in place. The Marine Highway System is fortunate. We have a full-time environmental officer on staff that pays attention to these types of things and air emissions and a host of other regulations that we need to comply with. So we do try to make sure that our sampling procedures and our crews are trained in those processes so that we get accurate results.
That is very helpful information to know there's an environmental engineer on board or officer on board at all times. So that's helpful. Senator Hughes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question about the 1% ART. There's potential, as I looked at the fiscal note, altogether with current and planned, a $3.9 million savings by this. But the question is, are we going to, if we don't apply the 1% ART, are we going to use that 3.9 for other things in building those ferries, or will we actually realize a savings of 3.9? Because the way it's written, you could use that 3.9 for building. So I just want to know if the cost, if with this, if every penny matters at this point. Thank you.
To the chair, Senator Hughes, I agree. Every penny does count, and we are counting our pennies. To answer your specific question, I'd like to split it into two categories, and let me talk about the Alaska-class ferries first. The construction contract that was let for the two Alaska-class ferries being built in Ketchikan right now was a $101 million construction contract. So technically, by the statute, $1.01 million would need to be set aside and dedicated to artwork for those vessels. There won't be a savings of $1.01 million if this bill is enacted, because those vessels are actually underfunded. As part of the effort to keep the construction cost of those vessels within the allowable budget, concessions were made. There was items designated to be state-furnished equipment, like life-saving slides, radar, some other kind of essential equipment to have the ship functional, that were listed as state-furnished equipment to be funded from other sources and provided to the construction contractor rather than buying it through the construction contractor as part of the contract. So the elimination or the exemption of this particular vessel, these two vessels, from the 1% for ART requirement would allow that money to be used to provide the necessary equipment, the life-saving slides, the radars, as opposed to artwork for the vessels. And we would still need to come up with the additional money for the other equipment that the vessels needed to be fully outfitted. Does that make sense?
Madam Chair?
Yes, follow-up, Senator Hughes.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the clarification. And I do just want to mention to the sponsor and forever who thought of this, it's good common sense to use the artwork that's on the other ferries that will be retired. So I just appreciate that. I wish we'd actually realize that savings, but thank you for the clarification.
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, I will add that the artwork off the motor vessel Taku, which is not being given away, at least not that I know of, that artwork has been taken off, inventoried, and is in climate control storage with the intention of reusing it on the Alaska-class ferries.
Thank you.
Further questions for DOT? I have one. What would you estimate the cost would be to the fleet without this exception, this exemption?
To the chair, the exemption for the ART or for the wastewater?
Pardon me, for the wastewater. Pardon me.
To the chair, the cost is based on a study that was done on the motor vessel Taku, of all vessels, to install an advanced wastewater treatment system that would meet the large cruise ship discharge standards. And that was done in, I think, 2009 timeframe. And the estimate at that time was $1.25 million for that single vessel. So that was 7 years ago. It will cost more today. That was for that one particular vessel. There will be other differences on the other vessels. And there's a lot of factors that go into that cost. The largest and potentially the most expensive is the fact that an advanced wastewater treatment system necessary to achieve the much higher standards is a much larger piece of equipment. It might not physically fit in the space that we have on the ships that's the marine sanitation device room. So there might actually need to be major structural alterations made to the ship to accommodate the equipment to achieve that standard. We haven't done detailed studies on all of those. That's certainly a risk, though, because these ships, when designed in 1963, when they first came online, the regulations were much less stringent than that.
Thank you. Helpful information. Further questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any additional questions for the sponsor of the bill? Anyone wishes sectional analysis or sectional going through on the bill or anything? All right. So at this time, we'll set the bill aside and bring it back in the near future. And that completes our agenda for today. So our next meeting will be Monday, February 6th, same time, same place. So at this time, we'll stand adjourned. Let the record reflect the time is 4:49 p.m.